The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning, everyone. Wow, you all look so beautiful. It's kind of nice to lift our head up from that 45-degree and take everyone in. So we're settling in. And where I notice the settling in the most, can you hear me? Yeah? Where I notice the settling in the most is in our chanting. So maybe our service, we're learning new positions and feels a little wonky maybe for us, but it's perfect. It's exactly the way it's supposed to be. And I can hear the samadhi in our chanting. And it makes me think of the opening of the Vimalakirti Sutra that others have shared about as well, when all these countless bodhisattvas show up and present the historical Buddha Shakyamuni with their parasols, these individually bedazzled and bejeweled and gorgeous in their own way parasols. And he uses his supernatural powers and turns them into one parasol that covers the whole sky. And like a few people, Soshin, Hoshi, you know, said there, I had a little bit of, oh, Vimalakirti. It's so flowery. It's so sort of not Zen, you know, in my opinion. Why aren't we, you know, studying something that's, you know, more just Dogen or, you know, more accessible, if you can say Dogen is accessible, than this flowery Vimalakirti Sutra, you know, filled with supernatural events. And yet, as we're chanting, I recognize that that coming together of multiple voices as one is supernatural. It's not natural for us to come together in that way and create one sound. So is that so different? Maybe not. There's a handful of people here, at least, that I'm just getting to know, or I've only met prior to dinner last night. And I think again of the supernaturalness of things, where 19 years ago, sitting on Washington Street in Enkyo Roshi's small apartment, and now there's people from New Rochelle, New Paltz, Hyannis, Pioneer Valley, all these sort of extended branches of our Sangha, where we're still in Enkyo Roshi's living room. So how does that work? How did we fit in? And we're doing this radical thing where we're sitting in silence together. You know, who does that? We do. So it's kind of amazing. And historically, our last session of the summer was called Cicada, the Cicada session. And we would sit up at the Grail, and you heard all the sounds of nature, including lawnmowers and and what have you. But there was a part of me that, you know, went, oh, you know, we've got the buzz of an air conditioner. But cicadas, air conditioner. Trying to let go of that mind of picking and choosing, but I will say not sitting in a puddle of my own sweat is really a delight. So I think where we are is perfect, and in morning kinhin, morning doves. I went, ah, yeah, we're at the Grail too. We're also there. So this Karuna session, there might be a few of you in the room going, what, big Kahuna session, what is it? What is this Karuna that we're talking about? It's a word that in the Mahayana traditions, in the Zen tradition, we don't hear so much. It's heard a fair amount in the Theravadan traditions and in other traditions. And it's in the Theravadan traditions grouped with, it's in a group of four, in the four abodes. So you have Karuna, which is compassion. You have metta, loving kindness, equanimity, which is upekkha, and mudita, which is joyful or sympathy or sympathetic joy. So in the Mahayana tradition, we pair it with prajna. So we've got on the one hand prajna and on the other karuna. And Joshin Roshi, who recently received Inca and is a Roshi now, in her workshop described them as the two wings of a bird. And I thought that that was so beautiful. I don't know if that shows up elsewhere in our tradition, but you know, for us to take flight, as it were, the wisdom needs to be there and the compassion needs to be there. And they're not so separate. In fact, I don't think one arises without the other. We're not going to see them individually. As soon as our delusions are sort of let fall away, prajna is going to be right there. It's never not been there. And when that arrives, compassion is right there with it. We have no choice but to act compassionately when we're in our true selves and our true identity. So where there's one, you're going to find the other. So while I'm getting to know some of you, maybe you want to know a little bit about me. I'm not going to share too much, but so my name is Joan. I work as a nurse, and I work currently in an elementary school. I'm proud to say I graduated from kindergarten last year, and I'm moving on to the first grade in September. I work one-on-one with a child with SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. So he's in an electric wheelchair, and I meet sort of his ADLs, his activities of daily living, make sure that his airway is clear if he needs to be suctioned because he can't kind of clear his own secretions and doesn't really have control of bowel and bladder. And so it's a lot of just sort of parenting, and it's great. And I'm really liking the school education schedule because, hey, when I was working in other areas, getting away for an entire session was almost impossible. But now I can be here for the full thing. So, and prior to nursing, I danced for a while. I danced professionally. I was very fortunate to be doing that at a time when you could do that. While doing that, I got licensed to be a massage therapist, and that sort of supplemented my dancing. And then I transitioned as the body stopped sort of being able to do the dancing so much into doing massage fully. But there was a nagging sort of, I want to be of more service somehow. And so I became a nurse. And it was really my Zen practice that informed that decision. And I don't think it's so uncommon for us as Zennies to seek out the helping professions. And I really, as I think of that, I take umbrage with the word helping profession. I think it's very classist. You know, it sort of says, well, I've received an education and I can help you now. Where, you know, the migrant worker who picked those blueberries for our smoothie this morning is pretty helpful, you know, sure made my breakfast complete. So what helping profession, what profession is not helping? So, and a few things happened in my life as well to kind of push me towards nursing. I had some of my own health issues, and I was met with such profound karuna by a handful of people, not all, but a handful, that I said, that's so skillful, I want to do that too. So how do we develop this compassion? How do we do it? Do we point ourselves towards it? You know, the old saying, you know, how do we seek the way? Do I point myself towards it? No, that's not what you're going to do. I think we just have to unveil it. It's there. So these researchers in Italy, about 15, 20 years ago, I don't really have the exact date, but at any rate, they discovered neurons that are, they are now called mirror neurons. And they're in the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, and I'm not going to get into the science of it, one, because I don't really understand it fully myself. Two, that's not what this is about. But suffice it to say, you know, we learn as, you know, small children, you know, you see someone reach out and grab something, and those neurons are sort of firing before you even have the musculature to do that. And a really, you know, sort of poignant example of that is the stubbed toe. the, you know, you see someone stub their toe, and all of that is firing in you as well. You go, ah, you know, you shake, you know, that, ah, 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 you make that noise, like knowing fully what that pain feels like. I just recently saw my husband have a cabinet open in the kitchen, reached down below and stood up, forgetting the cabinet was open. We've all done it. And and interestingly, some of the research, as an aside, is looking at autism, and that autistic children and autistic people are lacking this motor neuron, this mirror neuron. A little controversial. Not everybody agrees, but many do. And so I would argue our sympathy, our compassion is built in. Joshin Sensei in our workshop said, we are a mass of nerves responding to arising causes and conditions. And it really sort of stuck with me. I said, yeah, that's what we are. And during my shuso a while back, we went to the body exhibit in New York. And I don't know if anyone had an opportunity to see it. A little controversial about where those bodies came from, maybe. But that aside, there was one exhibit where it's amazing that they can do this. They teased out the entire nervous system. Well, almost the entire nervous system. Some of it is so, you know, microscopic that it's almost impossible to do. But somehow they melted away all the rest of the body, and there was a brain and a spinal cord and all the afferent and efferent, all the information coming in and going out. And it's just amazing to sort of see it standing there, you know, and it really kind of brings together this idea that is what we are, part of what we are. So our compassion is built in. We don't have to actually cultivate it. And much like our wisdom, it just needs to be realized. It just needs to be unveiled. And Zazen is a great way of doing that. It's a solvent that will kind of dissolve all the bullshit and allow our true nature to come forth and our compassion itself to come forth. And it's not just happening with human beings now. We had a recent article, I think in the Times, about trees communicating with each other, that they talk to one another. And you know, one tree will say, oh, well, I've had my fill of water. I'm good, I'm sated. Oh, but that pine next to me, that pine is a little thirsty. So I'm gonna turn off my drinking mechanism and allow for the pine or the maple or whatever it is next to me to have a good long drink. And how is that not compassion? And I recently saw a clip on good old Facebook, but of a mother, a lioness, walking with her cub to the watering hole. And the cub was weak with dehydration, and mom was weak with dehydration, maybe unable to pick her, you know, cub up by the scruff and get it there. And there was an elephant who was nearby, and the elephant wrapped its trunk around the baby cub and carried it to the watering hole for the lioness. So kind of amazes me that in nature, two beings that in another context might see each other as a threat or an enemy, another, are able to do that. You know, maybe if we could see that as ourselves, you know, we wouldn't talk about building walls and excluding. We would just lift up and carry to the watering hole. So compassion is the key in that, and it's happening in nature. There's countless examples of it. And when we allow ourselves to just be ourselves, our true nature to come forward, our prajna wisdom to come forward, the compassion is going to be there. So what gets in the way? What blocks us from experiencing that, from manifesting it, from actualizing it? Our acculturated self, our
fears, our likes, our dislikes, our desires, absolutely those get in the way, make it next to impossible to allow those natural states to be present. But I think we can do something even worse, where we can beat ourselves up about it a little bit as well. So as Buddhists, you know, we have this idea maybe like, I'm supposed to be like Avalokiteshvara. I need to have all these ears and eyes and hands and able to respond, you know, as an endless font of compassion. Good luck with that. I know it didn't work for me. I try, but it's not easy. And then I might tell myself a story of, I'm a lousy Buddhist. I'm horrible at this. I'm not compassionate. I have horrific thoughts about people. I triangulate with someone to elevate myself and make myself feel better about you know, who I am and my station in things. I don't think it's uncommon. Maybe I'm the only one in the room who does it. And if so, wow, mea culpa. But I think we all can do it. We can fall prey to that that thing, you know. And that's you know, we're trying our best in this onslaught of pain and suffering, and particularly in this world of media, you know, and Twitter and all the forms of information coming in, and so much of it telling us, look how much suffering there is. It's easy to slide into that state of, I'm not enough, I can't respond to this. It's impossible. And that might be where what is often called compassion fatigue arises. We're exhausted, and it is exhausting. It is, there's no doubt to it that it is exhausting. And for folks in certain careers, and again, I'm not, you know, saying that the migrant worker doesn't experience this, that my boiler guy, who is absolutely in a helping profession with my broken boiler, can fall prey to this too, absolutely. I remember driving to my job in the emergency room in Hudson, and I'd have CNN on the radio, you know, listening to a shooting, a tornado, a, you know, outbreak of a disease somewhere, you know, just one horrific story after another. And then in my scrub pocket, I have my phone on vibrate, but it's buzzing away and I can feel it. And when I finally would have a chance to look, I'd be like, oh, another tragedy. So that information just coming in again and again and again. And out of that compassion fatigue, tied to it closely, is burnout. So when do we burn out? When do we shut down and say, I can't, I'm gonna just do the bare necessity and stay on the margins of this so that I can get a paycheck, I can appear as if, but I'm not gonna fully witness this because it's too much. And there's new research coming out by a psychiatrist called Jonathan Shea, who is a teacher and a psychiatrist and a researcher. And he's saying, it's not burnout. And I tend to agree with him. There's no such thing as burnout. What there is moral injury. So we're built, as I said, we're absolutely built as compassionate, caring, empathetic beings. But maybe the system fails us sometimes, you know? So what is our job? Maybe we need to talk about changing the system. Certainly that's true for anyone, and I see a few faces that I know for sure are nurse practitioners and MDs and chaplains, but we hear about it so much with suicide rates with our border patrol and our immigration officers, police officers, firefighters, EMTs. But I'm going to stretch that to everyone. Everyone can experience this fatigue. So, and of course, you know, the answer in the hospital setting is we're going to get a wellness officer. We'll pay him three times what you get. And they're going to come by and say, you look burned out. You look really tired. The massage therapist is offering 10-minute chair massages in the grieving room. And here's a 4x4 piece of gauze with some ylang ylang and lavender. So, oh, well, that fixed it. That all better now. So it's not, we're never, this neurological system is never going to fail you. It's impossible to deplete your compassion. It's a natural manifestation of our walking of the Buddha path, of our waking up, and of our just seeing, not doing, just seeing, just bearing witness to things as they actually are. So Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, how does the Bodhisattva enter the Buddha path? Vimalakirti said, if the Bodhisattva treads the wrong ways, he enters the Buddha path. Manjushri asked, what do you mean by the Bodhisattva treading the wrong ways? Vimalakirti replied, in his work of salvation, and we might say, in his work of seeing, in his work of bearing witness, being present, regarding, paying attention. If a bodhisattva is free from irritation and anger while appearing in the fivefold uninterrupted hell, is free from the stain of sins while appearing in other hells, is free from ignorance, arrogance, and pride while appearing in the world of animals, is adorned with full merits while appearing in the world of hungry ghosts, does not show his superiority while appearing in the heavenly worlds of form and beyond form, is immune from defilements while appearing in the world of desire, is free from anger while as if he were resentful, uses wisdom to control his mind while appearing to be stupid, appears to be greedy but gives away all his possessions, etc., etc. It goes on for about six pages. And it's a tall order, you know. This is not an easy thing to do, you know. And I think particularly of our Jukai recipients. And I remember back to when I was taking it, and I thought, and after I get this Roksu, well, then I'm really gonna, you know, do the work. I'm gonna not have an impure thought. I don't know what I thought, but I thought that somehow, you know, there was going to be this change, this shift, that I was going to be, you know, better at it. Secret, you don't really get better at it. You just have to work and recognize and see things as they are. But it's easy to put on the metaphoric body armor to decide, I don't want to see that. I don't want to feel that. It's too much. I'm gonna, you know, kind of push it to the margin and not fully experience it. I always think of this nurse who I loved, a charge nurse in the ER. And whenever any nurse, and the first time I think it was me, I don't even remember what the situation was, but you know, Mr. Jones, you know, was having a particularly horrible day. Not that anyone coming into the emergency room for care is, you know, like, hey, this is great. Usually it's because things are pretty deep. And, you know, I was talking to her and I said, you know, it just breaks my heart. This is so horrible. What's happening to this man? And he's got no recourse and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And she looked at me and she said, sympathy is between shit and syphilis in the dictionary. And, you know, there was a lesson there. It allowed me to see that this hotshot nurse that I regarded, who could do anything, she could, you know, nurse circles around most of our MDs on the floor. She'd been doing it for years, and she couldn't. She couldn't see, couldn't look at it, you know. She did her job. She got it done. She could get an IV into anything, anything. But sympathies between shit and syphilis. I had to look just to check. It's actually, and you'll love this, or I loved it, it's between symmetry and symphony. I cheated a little bit. There's a lot of sympathetic, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, the two words that don't have to do with sympathy are symmetry and symphony. And I thought, symmetry, selfing self, seeing not the other. It's symmetrical, it's equal, and it's harmonious. It's in song. So I used to live in Provincetown. I made a note to drink. It's right there, so I'm gonna do it. I used to live in Provincetown, and there's gorgeous beaches there, as some of you probably know, and great waves. A little scary now with the global warming and the sharks showing up all the time. Not so excited to go swimming when I come up. Sejin, I'm not going in the water. But you know, these waves can come one right after another. And when you want to get into them and ride them and playing them, you got to dive directly into it before it crashes on you. And you got to swim out a little way to where they're not breaking. You got to get into it. You've got to be fully immersed to not get barreled over. And when they do hit you, they'll knock you right to the ground and drag you on the bottom, scrape you up good. Working in the clinic in Provincetown, I saw it all too often. I turned my back, I turned away, and I got slammed. So maybe when we turn away from this pain, when we turn away from this suffering in an effort to protect ourselves, ultimately probably doesn't work so well. Maybe you can get away with it a couple of times, but sooner or later, it's gonna. I think it's in the suffering together, the come together, passion, suffering, the doing it together, recognizing that we're not alone in it. When we're ourselves in profound pain and suffering, recognizing that I'm not doing this alone. And when we see the other, in loose quotes, suffering, recognizing that that's not separate from me. Their pain is my pain. So here in Sesshin, we have this opportunity to recharge. You know, it sounds a little new age to me, you know, but it's true. Sesshin, that solvent of silence, that can dissolve away, you know, all the trauma that this world offers us, and putting the social media down, walking away from the onslaught for a moment, doesn't mean that it's gone. It's still happening, and God knows you can spend period after period in profound pain on the cushion with what's ever going on. It's not that we've stepped away from it, but it gives us an opportunity to really put a little space in between us and it and see it for what it actually is, and gives us an opportunity to kind of refuel and go back into the world and be the bodhisattvas that say, I'm wired for compassion. That's what I am. And I can do this. I can face those waves. I can dive in. I can swim. Roshi Joshin offered us a poem at the end of, a song, a snippet of a song from Leonard Cohen at the end of our workshop, towards the end of our workshop, at the beginning of this week, that I told her, I'm stealing it, I'm taking it. I want it for my talk because it speaks directly to this, I think. We're not gonna do it perfectly. We're just not. But we have to remember, or I have to remember, that it's there, even in the moments where I feel I'm not enough, I'm doing this poorly, I'm a lousy Buddhist, it's still present. So this is just a portion of Leonard Cohen's song, Anthem. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. I'm going to read it one more time because it's worth it. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.